my little head mic isn't working today, so I've got to go back to old school. So if I start preaching with both arms out and you can't hear me, then that's probably what that's about. Today I want to speak about a word. And whenever I use a Greek word, I know that some people here think, whoa, this is a really deep sermon. So if you're one of those people who are inclined to get really excited about Greek words, then prepare yourselves for excitement. But there's one word in the New Testament that we hear a number of times, and because you may not know Greek, you may not be reading this morning from your Greek New Testament, as I never do, so I'm with you here. But there's a word that keeps coming up and up and up, and I want to have a look at it. It's the word, it looks like this on the screen, it's thaumazo. Thaumazo. Can you all say it after three? One, two, three. Thaumazo. It's beautiful. Your Greek is perfect to my ear. And this word means to be in awe of, to marvel at, to be like, whoa, that's amazing, to be amazed. That's what this word, thaumazo, means. And as we look through the New Testament, especially through Jesus' life, there is a number of times where this word, thaumazo, comes up, because there are people around Jesus that when they saw how he was, what he did, how he interacted with people, they were in awe. They were amazed. The disciples were on a boat with Jesus out on this lake, and many of them who were fishermen were scared out of their brains, because at this point in time there was a huge, massive storm, and the disciples thought that they were going to die, these hardened fishermen. And then they say to Jesus, wake up, wake up, aren't you afraid that you know we're going to die? And Jesus stands up and just says to the storm, be still. And the disciples were thaumazo. The disciples were amazed. They were like, whoa, how did he do that? There was another guy who he was, the Bible explains, filled with demonic spirits. He was known by others. Others would stay away from the area where he was because they were fearful of how he would attack them, how he would act towards them. So he was like pushed away, shunned by his society. Jesus came, and when Jesus spoke with him and he saw the demons possessing him, he just said, come out, and the demons fled. The people standing around saw that, and they were thaumazo. They were amazed. How did Jesus have authority over demonic spirits? How did that happen in this way? How did it? They just went, whoa, who is this man? Who is Jesus? And there were many other opportunities where this same kind of thing happened, where it seemed as though it was just absolutely out of what's humanly possible. I mean, Jesus healed so many people that even to say that, we can get used to thinking about Jesus and kind of think, oh yeah, he healed people, you know, big deal, he was Jesus. But he healed people. People who couldn't see could see. People who couldn't walk could now walk. And it says that the people who were around Jesus at that time saw, and they were amazed. They were in awe. They were thaumazo. They just went, oh, I can't believe this. And because this is kind of the December, we're in the Christmas run now, we can start transitioning into Christmas things, obviously, clearly behind us and with the carol. So I thought, what are the thaumazo moments of Christmas? And when the angels came to a bunch of shepherds out in the fields near Bethlehem, and when they spoke to the shepherds and said that a Saviour, the Messiah, had been born just down in Bethlehem, they ran down them to Bethlehem to see Jesus. And the people around, when the shepherds came and told them that these angels had turned up and started singing, it said they were amazed. They were thaumazo. They just couldn't believe what these shepherds had said. A few days later, Mary and Joseph go to the temple to have Jesus dedicated. And when they took Jesus to be dedicated, Simeon the priest came out, and he again said, oh, the light of the world, the one we've been waiting for, he's here. And Mary and Joseph were thaumazo. They were like, oh, wow, we're just amazed that this is all happening in front of us. So do you get the sense of this word now, this sense of awe and this sense of, oh, wow? You get it? You think, if I took this away, would you all be able to know what that word was? No, I won't do that. There was a time where Jesus was thaumazo. When this word was used to describe something that Jesus heard. And when I think about how all of these normal earthly people saw Jesus doing great things and they were in awe, they were amazed, they marveled, what then would make Jesus amazed? What would bring out this same word for Jesus? You know, that to me, it grabs my attention. I'm like, oh, I want to know what this is. If Jesus was amazed by something, what would kind of like get the King of Kings going, oh, wow, what would that be? I'm really interested to find out. Are you interested to find out what that might be? This is a tough crowd. I know that you're saving up some of your excitement for this evening with the carols and stuff like that. I accept that. But if something amazed people, if people could not walk and now could walk, and they're like, wow, that's amazing. If someone stopped a massive storm like last night, if someone just said, stop, and it just went totally calm and the clouds cleared and stuff like that, we would be amazed, right? So wouldn't you be interested to find out what amazed Jesus? Yeah. Look, you're getting better, but I think we've got some ways to go. Matthew chapter 8, if you've got your Bibles, this is where it's difficult with one hand, with a mic. All right. Matthew 8, starting in verse 5, when Jesus had entered Capernaum. Now, to give you a bit of context, Jesus lived his life as a man in the town of Capernaum, a larger town on the shore of the Sea of Galilee. So this is where Jesus grew up. Not grew up, but he lived as a man. It seems as though he had a house there. He kind of lived there most of the time. He had been away before this and had just come back to Capernaum. So he'd been away and he'd done some amazing things. And the stories were starting to trickle back about these amazing healings and everything that Jesus had done. So people had heard there's a bit of a groundswell coming. And then it says, when Jesus had entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him asking for help. Lord, he said, my servant lies at home, paralyzed, suffering terribly. So a centurion is not a Jewish person. He's a Roman soldier. And in the region of Galilee, the north of Jerusalem, the north of the country of Israel, in this region of Galilee, it was kind of like the backwaters. It wasn't the most important kind of place to be, but the town of Capernaum was big enough to be able to house a garrison for Roman soldiers. So in this town, it seems as though there was this centurion, a man who was a leader of 100 soldiers, and so he was also known, in the book of Luke we find out the same story expands a little bit more to say that he was actually a man who was in some way compassionate towards the Jewish people. So much so that he had helped to pay to build the temple. I mean, the local synagogue, like their local church in that region. So we don't know exactly where he stood with God, but we do know that he was a God-fearing man who seemed to respect the people. And so he came to Jesus and he said, Lord. And this is an important kind of little side point, because as a Roman centurion, the Romans being in charge over all of Israel, they were the ones who were the bosses, he came to Jesus, and even though he was socially and governmentally above Jesus, he came to Jesus and called him Lord. He gave this title of being underneath Jesus. He said, Lord, my servant lies at home, paralyzed, suffering terribly. And so he came to Jesus, humbled himself, called Jesus Lord, and then comes and asks Jesus. So he's heard about what Jesus can do, and he says, my servant's at home. And oftentimes we would think, okay, if he's a servant, he just does what his master says. But the concern that this centurion has must have been great. He must have loved his servant very greatly, because he didn't just say he's paralyzed, and which would mean that he's nearing death, he's not in a good way, but he also says he's suffering terribly. So there's a compassion here from the centurion that he desired Jesus to come and help him. It goes on and says, Jesus said to him, shall I come and heal him? The centurion replied, Lord, I do not deserve to have you come under my roof, but just say the word and my servant will be healed. For I myself am a man under authority with soldiers under me. I tell this one, go, and he goes, and that one, come, and he comes. I say to my servant, do this, and he does it. When Jesus heard this, he was amazed. And he said to those following him, truly I tell you, I have not found anyone in Israel with such great faith.
this is where Jesus was amazed. This is the point where Jesus is thaumazoed, where Jesus goes, oh, wow. What this centurion just said got Jesus to have the same reaction as people said to him when he was healing people, calming storms and removing demonic spirits. Is that interesting? Jesus looked at what this guy said and he was like taken back. He's like, oh, wow, I've never had this kind of faith expressed in my whole life in all of Israel. I've not seen this before. Why was he so impressed at this centurion's faith? It's an interesting thing to kind of ponder. Because absolutely the centurion was asking something that no one else had asked. He was asking for a long distance prayer request. Okay? He was asking for Jesus not to actually go to his house, but to just say the word and he would be healed. He understood that Jesus had authority greater than anyone else. And his authority didn't need him to be there, but his authority meant that he could do a long-distance healing. So Jesus was so encouraged by this centurion recognizing that there was something in Jesus' life that he could heal, not just here, but anywhere. The centurion realized that Jesus was bigger than anyone else had ever realized how big he was. The other part was, though, that absolutely the faith side was a really important thing, but it was the way in which this Roman centurion understood authority that helped him to understand what it was that Jesus could do. So he said, you know, I tell this person to come, this person to go, they do it. I'm a man under authority. So he understood the hierarchy of how authority worked. And I think this is coupled with his faith, or it helped drive his faith. He was able to understand that Jesus had greater power and authority than other people recognized that he had. And where we go and we see through the words of the Bible, time and time again, people were wondering, wow, Jesus spoke with such great authority. Jesus spoke. Where does he get this authority from to heal? How can he do this? And so time and time again, people were questioning about Jesus' authority. And here we have a man that immediately sees, Jesus, you have such authority that you don't have to just heal here, but that you can heal anywhere. Jesus, after being amazed, then says, there are going to be people in this country of Israel who should have known my authority but have ignored it, and they then will be separated from God for eternity because of the way that this is playing out. So as we read the next bit, it's like, wow, Jesus is really condemning people for not submitting to and seeing his authority. Then he says to the centurion, then Jesus said to the centurion, go, let it be done just as you believed it would. And his servant was healed at that moment. I mean, this is an interesting point if you were a disciple around Jesus. Because, one, Jesus was saying, wow, I have never seen this much faith. And his disciples are all around him. He's saying, I've never seen any faith. You see this guy? See how amazing his faith is? Wow, he's really great. And his disciples are like, come on, Jesus, you know, we're here. You know, we have faith, you know, like Andrew pipes up and says, remember that kid who had 5 loaves and 2 fishes? I came and brought that kid to you. And Jesus is like, yeah, come on, Andrew. You had no faith. You just thought that would be enough. But you know, like as Jesus went on, he's looking at these guys saying, I've not seen anyone with that great faith as much as this centurion. You guys are still here. The other part I think they were thinking, well, what made me think was that suddenly they probably thought, oh, wow, we don't have to go and travel so much anymore. We can just do all of our ministry right here at Capernaum. Maybe people could send prayer requests in and Jesus could just heal them. We can have a soft, comfy bed. We can live with our families. This is great. Unfortunately, Jesus didn't also invent like satellite TV, so they couldn't really satellite out the gospel message from there. But I think they were starting to think, wow, Jesus can do a lot more than what we first had thought. But what I want to focus on today is to look at how this centurion really viewed authority and how in our lives we find it a lot harder to be able to think in the terms of authority like this Roman soldier would think of in terms of authority. I don't know if you've noticed or if you've recognized kind of a lack of authority in our world around us today. That there are people who find it very hard to sit under other people's authority. Yet when we look at biblical authority, when we look at what Jesus was praising this guy for, it was that he understood that there was a God above him. And that he had to submit completely, like he would have to, the Caesar or a general above him. He understood that he would have to submit in this way. And so too he understood that he needed to submit to Jesus in this way. But then when we look at our lives, we say, well, how do we go with authority? How do we fit? If we were in that same situation, would we be able to say, Jesus, I just absolutely trust you because I know that you're above me, and everything in my life I submit to you because you're the greater authority? How do we go with giving God authority, Jesus authority, in our entire lives? And how much is it that we like to give segments of our life authority to God? And on from that, the second question then leads to, if God has placed people in authority over us, how do we go dealing with people in our lives who are meant to be authority figures above us? Do we accept the authority that they have, or do we try to push against it? Do we try to fight the authority, or do we embrace it? And in people in authority over us, is anything from the bosses in our workplaces, the government that's above us, the police that are enforcing our laws, the teachers at our schools, the parents that we have in our families. It might be elders, deacons, pastors, there's a church level. We have a number of people who are in authority over us. The Bible seems to direct us to believe that how we deal with those over us is how well and successful we'll be at being able to be over those under us. There's a quote I read from a guy called Adrian Rogers, and he wrote a book called The Incredible Power of Kingdom Authority, and he said, "We will never be over those things that God has set under us until we learn to be under those things that God has placed over us. There is strength through surrender." That's an interesting one to kind of sit on a little bit, isn't it? It's a big thing to kind of get our heads around. Because I want the amazement. I want the faumazo. I want to be just amazed by all the great things. But I don't know if I'm quite as excited about kind of being under the authority of someone. You know, like I want all the great stuff. I want to see the healings, the miraculous, the great things. I want all that kind of stuff. But when you start saying you've got to submit to the authority of the Bible, oh man, well there's things in there that I'm not quite as happy to embrace. You know, I want the good things. It's like saying, oh, I want a six pack, but I don't want to do any sit-ups to get there. You know, like, I want all the great marks, but I don't have to do any study. I want to have all the Bible knowledge, but I don't really want to go through all that rigorous, boring effort of like reading and trying to memorize. I want. But the Bible seems to speak to us about knowing that if we want things, there's a way to attain it, and that way may not be as attractive as what we desire. It's going to be a lot harder to get there. And a part of that is in how we respond to those who are in authority over us. How we kind of submit ourselves underneath those people who are above us. And the Bible speaks to this in the book of Romans. It explains this a little bit more. It explains, and when I read this, I want you to be thinking about police and about government and about teachers and about the people who are over us in our lives. Romans 13:1 says, "Let everyone be subject to the governing authorities, for there's no authority except that which God has established. The authorities that exist have been established by God. Consequently, whoever rebels against the authority is rebelling against what God has instituted, and those who do so will bring judgment on themselves." That's a heavy word to be able to kind of sit under. Now, the context of the book of Romans, when Paul was writing this book to the church in Rome, there was heavy persecution going on. There was a guy at the top, a Caesar, named Nero. And Nero was a terrible guy for Christians. He persecuted Christians all the time. And there was different times in the empire where people were persecuted more and people were persecuted less. But in this time that Paul was writing, Nero was terrible towards the Christians. One story was that he would have garden parties and he would take Christians, cover them in pitch and tar and light them up to light the garden for his guests to be able to see by.
That's the level of horrible and terrible that Nero was to the Christians. So have that in your mind. And then Paul writes this to the church. He says, be submissive to those that God has put in authority over you. And we see one, and then we see the other, and we kind of think, no, God couldn't have allowed Nero. It must have been a mistake. Surely the best thing would have been for Christians to have had a really easy path to share their faith, to live and to love one another. Surely that would have been God's desired plan. And in many ways, sure, it would have been if we lived in a perfect world. But yet we have Nero in charge and Paul writing this that says that we have to sit under and honour those in authority over us. How can these two sit together? Well, with years of hindsight, looking back into that early church, what can we see that persecutions brought? Well, two key things that they brought. One was that people fled all over the empire. They didn't just live in Jerusalem anymore. They didn't just live in the capital cities that they'd moved to. They had to flee and move out. And as they went, they took their faith with them, and then they started little communities of faith everywhere they went. And so the gospel spread because of persecution. The other thing was, and I think this is interesting as well, is that the Christians knew that their lives weren't going to be long, you know, living a comfortable, relaxing life in a retirement village at 90. They realized that their lives were short, that they had to do everything they could to be able to share the gospel. And so they were far more passionate because of the persecution of sharing their faith and helping people to understand what it was to be a Christian. So we see these two kind of things acting. And even though Nero was a terrible emperor, we see at the same time God doing incredible things in spite of the governing authorities over the Christians. And so Paul, writing in this time, says, obey, listen to, be underneath the authority of others. Now we don't live in a day, not in our country, not in this area, where we are persecuted anything like that. I've never seen anyone lit on fire as a Christian. Not in Queensland, not here in Ipswich, right? Like that's not the case. So what do we do with this sense of authority? How do we sit under it? If we're not under persecution, we're under quite good government, how do we show our respect? How do we live in such a way to honour and respect those who are in authority over us? And I think there's a whole bunch of ways that we need to do this. One of those is in the way I believe that we speak. Because it's easy to look at other people and say, the kids of today, they just don't have the respect that we did growing up, this group of people, they're just not giving the authority that they should to the people. But what I hear in people just like me is the kind of complaints and vitriol and hatred towards government, towards police, towards people in authority that comes from adults. And then we wonder why kids kind of grow up with the same kind of thought. Whenever we speak and we say, oh, the police, they're only revenue raising or, you know, whatever it is, well suddenly what we're doing is we're speaking about a mindset of undermining authority that then when other people hear it, they're just copying us. When I hear another parent badmouth a teacher, I'm just thinking, oh man, if you're happy to badmouth a teacher to me and then your kids are going to hear this, how are they ever going to respect the teacher at their school? You know, yet we see all the time teachers being put down and hate, or the principal who's an idiot because they didn't do the right thing, love my kid in the right way. Well maybe we need, instead of putting people down, to start finding ways to lift them up. And we see this in government all the time. It seems to be like a circus, a madhouse. We're not called to go in and judge them and to put them down. We're just called to live under them. And it says that there's a blessing for us in that, if we sit under authority in the rightful way. There's a blessing because it means that those who look up to us, those who look at our lives and see how we live, they start to look at us and say, oh, well, if they're honouring people above them, then maybe I need to honour those above me. When we start to model honour
instead of this respect in our lives, then we don't actually just change ourselves and have a blessing in a lot of ways, as this verse mentions, that God will bring, but also others who see us will be more willing to be under us as well. And I'm aware that there are a lot of things in our world that need to have petitioned against them. That our governments are not perfect, that the police force aren't perfect, that teachers are imperfect as well. But I'm aware that I'm part of the problem, right? Like we're all part of the problem, that we are all imperfect. And there have been some great moves towards changing government through petitions, through speaking out and through actions. Slavery was one of the things that was petitioned against in the British Parliament, and slavery was ended. In America, there's massive race wars and terrible problems over there that ended up being fixed through education, through people recognizing that it wasn't the color of our skin that makes us any different, that things change over time because people speak out. So I'm not saying we shouldn't speak out. I'm just saying that there is an undercurrent of disrespect that I sense over our nation that kind of permeates through so many things of who we are as a people and as a culture. I don't know if you recognize this or see this at all, but we kind of lift up and we say that Ned Kelly's great. He's one of our great historic figures, you know, like a guy who was a thief. We sing a great song about a jolly jumbuck being stuffed into the swagman's tucker bag. You know, they're the kind of things that Australians celebrate. And so I understand that's part of our history. But it's not a great part, is it? It's not a part we should be celebrating and saying, oh yeah, people who steal stuff are great. Well, it should actually be the opposite. When we think back at the last 50 years, especially since the 60s, and a real push against authority, a push back against anything that might be over us, I think things as they've shifted have probably swung too far in that way of being disrespectful towards authority in the way that people kind of disrespect the things around them. And where this leads to, this disrespect, this pushback against authority is that when people under us start seeing us doing the wrong thing to those over us, then they start doing the same to us. I don't know if you've recognised this, but if you've got children or if you've had children, you know that there are times that they're disrespectful towards you, that they say things that they want to push against because you don't always say the things that they like. You don't always make decisions that they're fully agreeable to. And so they either learn to accept the authority and deal with it, or they push back against it and they fight it. They petition it. They go to war against us. It gets really hard and terrible and horrible. Now, how we go about dealing with that, in time, they'll grow up and they'll do the same to other authority figures over them. If they understand that to push back and to argue is the pathway, then that's what they'll do to bosses and to the police, the government. They'll do it to any authority figure over them. And where I think it really leads us in a big way is how we honour and respect God. Because there are a lot of people who kind of say and have this part understanding that, look, I'll take on God's authority as far as my sin goes. I know that I've done bad things and I need forgiveness of that. So I'll take that side of my life and I'll sub that out to God. I'll say, thank you, God, you can deal with that part. But then we want to hold back other areas of our lives. Or we look at what the Bible says as the authority. It should be authority of our lives. But we take it and say, yeah, but I don't understand everything in here, so I'd prefer to kind of take a bit of the Bible and push it off to the side because I don't understand it, or my culture disagrees with it, so I'd like to push that away. But we need to be consistent as believers in where we stand with the Bible. We need to actually say we either believe it all or we throw it all away. We can't pick and choose parts that we like and say, I'll be under the authority of God in these areas, but not these. And oftentimes what happens is if you really kind of look at it and play it out, what we're saying is, God, I think that you're really great as far as sin goes and you love me, and I really like that part of it. But as far as this other side goes, as far as sitting under you in this, I don't think that you've got it all right, God. You know, like, God, you probably don't fully understand. You know, the culture's changed, things are different now, so we need to be different. But instead we need to see that possibly the God who created the universe might, you know, just might have a better perspective of life than we who live within the universe might have. That when he tells us things through his word, that maybe even though it's difficult to do, maybe even though it's going to be harder for us, maybe even though it's going to take us longer to get to whatever or do, that maybe he's got a better store in plan for us, a better plan in store for us. Maybe he knows more than we could ever know. Maybe his ways are higher than our ways. And when we submit to that, when we submit to his authority and say, even though I don't understand Jesus, I'm going to submit to this and I'm going to learn and I'm going to dig deeper into it. I'm going to try to understand it more because me in my human self, with the sin and the history and the stuff that I've got in me, naturally wants to push back against you here, God. But I need to see that you're the authority. So I'll sit under that. And when we do that, that's where Jesus has this thalmazo moment. That's where Jesus, it seems, as we look at how he reacted to the centurion, and he went, wow, he understands, he gets it. And that's what God wants for us, that we would get it. That we would understand that he is the authority. That he is the one that we need to put ourselves under. And when we disagree with him, we need to be consistent enough to actually try to find out why. Is it us or is it him? And I've found in my life, it's generally me. I don't know if you found that in your life. If you found out that you're the one that's the problem and God isn't, maybe you found the other way. Maybe you need to keep digging into God a bit more. Because ultimately, when we look at this word authority, the first six letters is the word author. And when we're looking at authority, we've got to think, well, the one who is the rule maker, the one who is the truth, the one who is right, is the one who is the author, who created, right? Who's at the beginning. We get to name our kids because we're the author of them. We made our kids, so we get naming rights of them. If you start a business up, you can call the business whatever you want because you're the author, you're the beginning of that business. If you write a book, if you're the author, then you're the one who has the authority to write the names of the characters, develop the plot, do whatever you like. That's your creation. That's yours to deal with. And so God, as the creator of all things, is also the author of life and therefore must be the authority of life. Back to the Christmas story. I said this is a transition kind of sermon. We've got to come back to the beginning. And right at the beginning of the book of Matthew, we see that Joseph, fair enough, Joseph, he didn't kind of get that Mary being pregnant and him not being involved wasn't a God thing. I could probably have some compassion for Joseph in the midst of that. It's probably difficult to understand and get your head around, mainly because it's the first time it's ever happened before. And so Joseph, he was questioning whether he should keep with Mary or not. And he was thinking maybe of just divorcing her quietly and pushing her off and saying, well, clearly you can go and live with whoever it is that you got pregnant with. And then it says in Matthew 1:20, it says, then an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a dream and said, Joseph, son of David, do not be afraid and take Mary home as your wife, because what she has conceived in her is from the Holy Spirit. She will give birth to a son, and you are to give him the name Jesus, because he will save people from their sins. Joseph didn't get naming rights over his son because it wasn't his son who was coming through Mary. The baby who would be born was the author of life. John tells us that Jesus was there at creation, creating everything. He was there at the beginning. And so Joseph, sorry, you know, you're the dad, but you're not actually going to have naming rights. The author gets naming rights. And so this is the name that he's had from the beginning of creation to now he is Jesus, the Messiah, the one who came to save, who was and who is and who is to come. He has always been and always will be. And so in the midst of this, we have to see, if Jesus is the author, if he is the creator, then we need to bow before his authority. We need to see that who he was and what he said, what he did was
amazing was thaumazo. We just are in awe of what he's done. And when we put him in the rightful place and say, well, if you're the author, if you came and if you are the truth, then whatever you said, I have to live under. I might not like that. That might be difficult for me. That might be something that I push against and I try to grapple with you in. But if you're the author, then you've got authority. And if we have our names changed from being a not follower of Jesus to a follower of Jesus, then we get a name change. We have the author has stamped his name upon us. We become Christ ones. Yeah? We become Christians. That's the name change that we get that we then go by as we live through the world. And so as we hold that name and say, well, I am a Christ one, I'm a Christ follower, then what goes with that is the understanding that He is our Lord. He's the boss. He's the one above us. He's the one who has authority. And we need to sit under that authority if we're going to be the people He's called us to be. And as we sit under His authority, as we honour Him with how we live our lives, then He starts to grow our authority over others. He starts to grow our ability to be able to speak into people's lives. He starts to use us in different ways. He grows our capacity. He grows the way we can be used by Him because we're honouring and worshipping Him. If we get the first part right, then He grows the other part. He starts to use us in ways that bless others and help them to know who He is too, because we're honouring the author of life. This morning we're going to come around the table of communion and we're going to celebrate what it is to be under the authority of Christ. And this morning as we do this, I want our thought to be, I'd like to invite us to think through that God is the author of life. God is the one who created all things. He wrote the story of the world and then wrote Himself into it. He came into His story and lived amongst us. He came, as the book of Isaiah says, and dwelt amongst us. God with us. Emmanuel, God who's come to dwell amongst us. So this morning we're going to break bread and drink juice together as a sign of the connection we have with the author of life. And the connection is that not only was Jesus born and He lived the perfect life, but the thaumazo moment for each of us needs to be that this creator of all things, this author of life, willingly went to the cross because He saw that the greatest thing that separated us from Him is our sin, is the things that we do wrong. And so He came knowing that the only way for us to have a pathway back to God was that through His sacrifice. He came and allowed His body to be broken. He came and allowed His blood to be shed. And as we think about these elements, may we be in awe of the God who came to do this because He loved us so much. That He would not only just forgive us once, but every time we do things that offend Him and push against His authority, that we can come back to Him and ask for His forgiveness. Ask for His grace once more. Ask that He might take away those things that we've done wrong, that He might forgive us, so that we again can have a close relationship with Him. So before I ask you to come forward or to the back to take a cup or to take some bread, can I ask that you might just spend a moment considering what it is that Jesus has done for us as the author of life and how His forgiveness needs to penetrate into who we are. Let's just spend a moment asking for Him to forgive us of the things we've done wrong and thanking Him for all He's done for us.